Hello, everyone, and welcome to Madison BookBeat, your listener-sponsored community radio home for Madison authors, topics, book events, and publishers. I'm your host, Andrew Thomas. My guest today is poet Daniel Colaci for a conversation on his new collection, The Story of Your Obstinate Survival, published by the University of Wisconsin Press this past March. Daniel Colaci is an Iraqi Jewish American. A graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and a former fellow at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, he is the author of four books of poetry, Menolaria, Tradition, and American Parables, and The Story of Your Obstinate Survival, which we're discussing today. His work has appeared in numerous publications, including the American Poetry Review, The Believer Logger, Colorado Review, Denver Quarterly, Electric Lit, Granta, The Iowa Review, Poetry Northwest, and Best American Experimental Writing. Daniel has taught advanced writing, literature, and publishing courses at Augustana College, Marquette University, and the University of Iowa, most recently as a visiting assistant professor at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He currently lives in Iowa City, where he directs the University of Iowa's McGid Center for Writing. He is the co-founder and managing editor of Rescue Press. The Story of Your Obstinate Survival is a propulsive collection. It's very funny, uncannily mundane, and starkly surreal. The poems are a collision of juxtapositions and images, each one brimming with a vigor and vitality that demands rereading, reading aloud, and maybe even setting to music. The lyrical wordplay will stop you in your tracks, either with laughter or with an appreciation for the delightfully weird scenes unfolding before you. The poems speak to an obstinate persistence, to enduring beyond a routinely felt sense of an ending. Daniel Colaci, it's my pleasure to welcome you to Madison BookBeat.
Thank you so much, Andrew. I'm so delighted to be here.
One of the first things that caught me about your book was the cover of it, because it's a beautifully done cover. But even more than that was the title itself. It's the title, The Story of Your Obstinate Survival, and then it's set about in flames. Could you talk to us a little bit about the title and where you drew inspiration for it?
So yes, big plug to University of Wisconsin Press for all the work they did on the physical side of this book and making such a beautiful object. You are correct that the cover is engulfed in flames, and the bold titling of The Story of Your Obstinate Survival is really front and center. That title came to me while I was reading and sitting in on a seminar by the wonderful poet and educator and a mentor of mine, James Galvin, while he was teaching this Moby Dick class. And I had taken that class a couple times with him. And every time there would be phrases that would jump out at me, there would be new ways of thinking about what a story is, what a narrative is, whose story, it even is. And I started thinking a lot about that. And this phrase came up in chapter 69. It's called The Funeral in Moby Dick. And the phrase seemed to encapsulate for me many of the things that I was thinking about. You know, as I was writing this book, we were facing a pandemic. I was thinking about friendship. I was thinking about love. I was thinking about community. I was thinking about loss. And I was thinking about politics and trying to figure out what was that story? How did it relate to me? How did it relate to the world around me? And these poems that were coming out of that kind of internal discussion, I think, kept coming back to this idea of being obstinate, about finding a way to survive, and about understanding that no matter how difficult something is, there's a way through it, even if the way through it is burning it all down. And so throughout the book, there are a handful of narrative arcs that sort of act as like a Venn diagram, where in the middle there seems to be this speaker that is going through these experiences, and as sort of the reader is reading these things, the narrative is pretty fractured. And my hope is that throughout the book, the poems stand individually, but as you read on and read through and get to the end, there are ways in which you realize all stories kind of have some central elements that pull us through them as readers, and we can kind of understand that there are ways to move on. And a lot of that, again, came from this experience of of rereading Moby Dick. At that point, it was the third time I'd gone through it, and just really thinking about giving myself space as a writer and an artist and a citizen to take risks. You know, I think that for me, the book really hinges on the inspiration that I found from my teachers and my community to push me further to say, art can be what you want it to be, even if it's in an aspirational sense.
Yeah, Moby Dick is such an amazing work because it is jam-packed with so many different things. It's messy, it's big, it has moments of very delicate beauty. And, you know, it seems like Melville is really pushing the novelistic form to its limit. Mm-hmm. And similarly, it takes on a kind of a propulsive energy that sometimes an individual section is only magnified many, many chapters later. And I felt similarly about your work, that as I continue to read, even if precise understanding wasn't always there, it started to take on a kind of almost kind of like an atmospheric meaning, that as we continue to return to certain phrases, certain key players, certain tropes, that something greater started to emerge from this. Can you continue to talk about that? Like, what was it like for you to take risks as a poet in this particular collection?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and you're 100% right. You know, Moby Dick is this, it's big, it's propulsive. I loved all the words you used and the way you described it. I think the more that I read it and the more that I started to look at what Melville was doing, I did find a sense of permission to, it's not just to be weird and take risks, but also a permission to trust the reader. That if I gave the reader everything up front, I would be doing all of the work, which is okay, I'm the artist. But also the reader might feel like they're not actually included. They're just being emotionally talked to. Or talked at. And I wanted the reader to really feel invested in this book in the ways, thankfully, that you described that you were. I wanted them to see how things could connect. I wanted to see them to see how things could feel disconnected and then come back again at the end, because that's the way that life works. You think something is moving one way, it changes directions. You think it's done and it comes back in another way. You know, in another life, and if I had more perhaps intellect in time, I would love to be someone who's able to write prose more effectively. Even when I do sit down to write prose, I tend to turn it into poems. But I've long been just an admirer of what a story is. And with this book, my goal, very much, as you've noted, inspired by Melville, but also by, you know, at the time I was reading a lot of James Merrill as well, looking at things like The Changing Light at Sandover. And I wanted to play with narrative. I wanted to think about what it would mean to put poems together in a way that attempted to tell or untell some stories that maybe we tell ourselves, or that maybe that are told to us, or maybe that happened, or maybe that never happened. And there's just no way of knowing. And I wanted to uncover some of that through language and give myself permission to be, as you said, a little bit messy, while also trying, who knows if it was successful, to rein some of that mess in a way that at the end, hopefully it comes together and you realize things were very purposeful. I think that there's a lot of organized chaos in this book. There will be readers that think it's fully surreal. And yet to me, it doesn't actually feel that way. Those images, those lines, those poems and narrative fragments and phrases and images, they all very much to me not only have a clear meaning, but they also, I think, add up upon one another to give us hopefully this larger emotional resonance. So when we leave the book, we kind of end with that emotional tone of letting something go and still being able to move forward.
Can you build a little bit on that with attention to the word obstinate? That was something that I really latched onto in the title, because, you know, it could be the story of your survival. Can you talk about how obstinance factors in as a thematic or even poetic tactic?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think I've loved that phrase for so long. It's always been one since I first remember reading Moby Dick. It's just been, it's jumped out at me, and I feel like it met the moment, and my poems met met it. It just felt fortuitous to kind of put them together. But I think, and I'm not here to talk politics. We can have that conversation off air. But since 2016 up through 2020, through the pandemic and beyond, many of us have been living in a world where it feels like, from individual rights to just opportunities, that things are being stripped away and taken down. And when you add to that one's personal life, relationships, as I mentioned before, friendships, the death of loved ones, the changing of from jobs to houses, whatever it might be, things can start to feel like it's all collapsing at all times. And the idea of obstinance to me, this idea of a kind of stubborn unwillingness or refusal to kind of let go or move, it's not to me this idea that one can't change their opinion or their idea. It's more about the empowerment of recognizing that fighting for what one believes in, even if others are telling them it's not possible, or fighting through something that's hard, will pull you out on the other end, and there is a way to survive. There is a way to make it through, even if it's difficult, and we don't have to bend our will to the structures around us, whether that is societal, political, economic, et cetera. And that empowerment, that resistance, felt very personal to me, and it also felt very in the air in these years since 2016. Obviously, resistance has been in the air for a long time. I just think as I was writing these poems, I couldn't avoid it. You know, a lot of things happened during the times that these poems were written and revised and looked at, and that was, as I've mentioned before, everything from elections and riots to getting married, losing loved ones and gaining new loved ones. And I think that's what life is, and that's what survival is, and that requires a bit of obstinance.
I really like the term obstinance kind of as a stand-in or a potential replacement for hope, to be honest. Like I found something very kind of comforting and kind of gritty about obstinance and the fact that like it's not going to necessarily be easy, it's not going to be enjoyable, but there's something to obstinance that I was more kind of readily able to grasp onto than like, oh, we need to be hopeful about the future.
Yeah, I really love that. I think without You've just put it in a way that I wish I could have. I mean, I agree with you 100%. I think there's something about the resistance and the fact that it's not easy that is itself a hope. That even if it's not easy, there's still a way to survive. There's still a way to make your art, be the person you want to be, succeed in whatever areas you want to, even when we face something. And that does start with hope. I really like that connection. Thank you for making it.
Absolutely. I mean, it was inspired entirely by the work. So we're thinking together here. I'm in conversation with Daniel Colaci on Madison BookBeat. I'm your host, Andrew Thomas, and we are discussing his new poetry collection, The Story of Your Obstinate Survival, published by the University of Wisconsin Press just this past March. Daniel, we're going to get into one of your poems in just a minute, but to kind of help our listeners who have not read this yet, there were three major elements of your poems that I kept coming back to again and again. And in no particular order, I saw that as wordplay, to the point of them almost having like a song-like quality or a lyrical quality, not necessarily lyrical poetry, but as lyrics to songs. So wordplay, what I was calling kind of like a collision of images or this juxtaposition of images, as well as humor. Some of these are very, very funny poems. How do you go about building a poem from the ground up?
Andrew, you should like be my hype man. you're picking up on so many of the things I was interested in, particularly with this collection. Music, particularly hip hop, has been and remains completely inspiring to me. I really love wordplay. I really love the idea of using language to be expressive and also using rhythm to add to that expressiveness. It's not just the word, it's the meter, it's the way in which the words are put together that can drop, fall, increase, demoralize, incense, or make somebody laugh. It can do all those things. And so it's a little bit like a puzzle. In terms of you understanding as the writer what are you feeling? What do you want the reader to come away with? And making sure that you are giving them enough to feel that way, and to hear that and to have that experience without also, as I was saying earlier, not trusting them, right? Not giving them too much. For me, in this book in particular, the structure of a lot of these poems came again from permission that I felt I was given from the people I was reading at the time. We mentioned Moby Dick. I mentioned a little bit of James Merrill, reading Changing Light at Sandover. But also the folks who I've had the great fortune of being around as friends and educators. I think often of Doug Powell. And Doug has always been someone who I've looked at as a poet who writes the poems that he needs to write and that he believes should be in the world. And he's not chasing any kind of art for the sake of what's popular or what's being written. He's writing the poems that he needs to write, and he's giving himself that permission. And so for me, I really tried to enter this book with that guard down a little bit and not worrying too much about what the audience was going to be or who was going to be reading or what types of books or poems were quote unquote popular at the time. I just wanted to get these out of my head onto the page and into the world. For me, the structure of these poems often starts with an emotion. I can't always identify it, and or response to a larger personal or societal ill that has befallen me, and I need to write about it or write it down. I very rarely directly write in response to something, but this book has a lot of direct responses. There's a whole series of poems in this book that are written directly to some of my friends. Their names have been removed, but they were effectively letters I wrote to the people in ways of me kind of understanding how I felt about these people and what I wish I could tell them in ways that I somehow am not able to tell them in a face-to-face conversation or a phone call or even an email. I needed a more creative space, like a poem. But I do follow images, I follow words, and the sound of words, and I give myself space to make sure that as I'm layering those images and those words, I'm not overcorrecting myself, and I'm letting myself really see, as you were talking about, where those juxtapositions go. Because I do want, we've been talking about obstinance, I do want these poems, I just read in Madison a couple of days ago, and I wanted to remind the audience that it was okay to laugh. I think some of these, especially when I read them, can feel really intense, and that's part of life. But I do think there's a levity to some of these, a very sort of dark humor, a gallows humor, if you will. But I think through humor and through absurdity, we might be able to get a better look at what's going on in the world, because what's happening in many cases is absurd. And so I write toward that idea, and I really try to use the tools that I have, as we were mentioning, the sound, the rhythm, the emotional tone that those two things can pull together to help understand for myself what I'm trying to write, and also help the reader get an idea of what they can take away from this piece and perhaps maybe go into their own world thinking about not what was Danny thinking about, but how does that poem make me feel, and how does that connect to how I feel about a loved one or someone I lost or the political world. You know, I don't use my name in any of these poems. I don't consider these poems to be nonfiction. I think these are artistic, creative pieces, yet they're very much rooted in the reality of the world that I see. As bizarre as I might see it, they're rooted in reality.
Are there certain poetic forms that are at the forefront of your mind, or is this something that you just find yourself kind of writing your way into by following these other points of entry for you, whether it be rhythm or sound? Are there particular forms that you are trying to work with?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I've always been interested, you know, maybe this is going to sound cheesy, I've always been interested in the idea of a sonnet. I've played with the idea of sonnets in previous books, and sort of deconstructing what a sonnet could be and what does a sonnet imply versus what is actually written in the sonnet you're writing, et cetera. Something that happened in this book, there's a long series of poems that were sort of inspired by the idea of a crown of sonnets, where you would have a collection of sonnets where the last line becomes the first line of the next sonnet, and then the last line of that sonnet becomes the first line of the next sonnet, and they sort of all hook back to the one at the beginning. And so I sort of took that idea, and then also took the idea of like sort of the iambic pentameter line, and really wanted to use that as a driving force to sort of play with, as we've been talking about, sort of rhythm and emotion and language and the ways in which language can be emotional based on where it's placed in the line, et cetera. And I wanted to give myself some room to kind of play with that form. So there is not a crown of sonnets in this poem, or excuse me, in this book, but the idea of the crown of sonnets is what inspired a whole section of this book, or a whole group of poems in this book. I think form to me is most exciting when I understand the form enough to break it. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I've been inspired by through other artists as well, is giving myself that space to not feel limited by what the structure commands, and yet oftentimes parts of that structure can command me to think in new ways. So if I hadn't have been thinking of the crown of sonnets and what that structure would be like, I don't think I would have written the poems both in the way that I did. I wouldn't have started to write them in the rhythm that I did. And those poems, that rhythm carried out throughout a whole group of these poems in this book.
And for our listeners, these poems are spread out through the entire collection. And, you know, it wasn't until kind of like a second read through that I started making some of these connections. But nevertheless, because it is this kind of because it's a repetition of a line from a previous poem, it folds into the larger work of the collection insofar that there are so many moments where things are uncannily familiar. They are strangely familiar. You've seen this come up in another way. You've seen this trope, or you've seen this line, and yet it's in a new position. And it was only going back and looking that I was like, oh wait a minute, these are sonnets. And so again, yeah. it's these great little moments of this seems familiar, but I can't quite put my finger on it. So I really liked that series throughout the collection.
I'm so glad. And also, I just really quickly want to say, you know, that idea of the familiar, and that I'm so glad you picked up on that, because that is something that I am really interested in, is sort of, again, giving the reader something where they sort of say, oh, I think, is this about this news thing I heard about? It's like something feels like it's very real. It's something that feels like it is part of a known quantity, and yet maybe the rest of it feels a little bit looser, or you know, a little bit more difficult to pin down. And something that I've taken from the wonderful short stories I've read, the wonderful novels that I read, so many of my friends that are terrific writers of prose or television shows in Hollywood, is this idea that kind of dropping some of these hints throughout, making subtle connections, maybe it takes multiple reads, but as long as they're there, you're sort of leaving these, yes, breadcrumbs for a reader, but you're also, I think, again, mirroring what it's like to kind of be alive, where there are mm-hmm. things that pop up that are, whether they're memories that you're reminded of or trinkets that you have on a shelf that pull you back somewhere else, the way you decorate a home to remind you of another place you were, et cetera. There are things that we do in the ways that we live that are these sort of memory adjacent articles of living that allow us to kind of move through the world with these connections and feel both like lost and found, you know?
Yeah, I like that. I like that description a lot. Memory adjacent. For our listeners, I feel like we're doing them a disservice at this point and not sharing some of this poetry, Daniel. So would you mind reading for us "For You on Your Birthday"?
Of course. This is "For You on Your Birthday." It comes about midway through the book. There's nothing really that the audience needs to know other than there are a lot of poems that address a you, and this is sort of one of them. For you on your birthday. For your birthday, I've baked you a cake of whole rabbit and parsley. I didn't use any yeast or flour, but the cake still rose because I left all the bones in. There was little preparation, so don't feel bad if it turns out you don't like it. When I put the pan in the oven, her fur caught fire. The flames set off my smoke detector, but once I spread her body over with mayonnaise, the hair singed dull and everything got quiet. I caught her in the courtyard, which means if you do end up liking it, I can try to catch another one and we can cook it together for our anniversary. I used chocolate icing, but I'm sure you can see that for yourself. I wanted to be with you when you tried it, but I don't have money for travel. None of the innards were removed, so be careful when you cut in. I remember one night you said my bones moved in my skin like a tent being raised underwater. I boiled her first so you'd feel better about diseases. When it was over, I clipped her toenails and blew dry her coat, which I realize now didn't matter. In the kitchen, it smells like wet wood and spilled kerosene, so I've opened a window. Your cake should cool before I send it. If I can get it to stay, I'll tie a blue bow around its middle. If I can't, just know I really wanted to.
You're listening to Madison Bookbeat, and I'm your host, Andrew Thomas. We just heard Daniel Colaci read from his collection, The Story of Your Obstinate Survival, published by the University of Wisconsin Press this year in March. Daniel, I read this poem to my partner this morning, and she immediately started laughing. this was a poem that I saw as both very humorous and strangely moving as well. Mm. Do you consider yourself an experimental writer? Is that what you would you consider this an experimental collection?
You know, I don't know, man. When I was sort of coming up in the world of poetry and going through my MFA program and starting to send out work, it did feel like what I was attracted to as an artist was on the outside of what the world of artists was willing to produce, if that makes sense. The books that I was writing, the poems that I was writing, they felt a little bit othered, both in terms of their content, but also in the style. And you know, art in general, like everything else, is a pendulum. Things come and go, and I've found ways, obviously, to find an audience, and I've been grateful for that. But I wouldn't consider myself experimental. I don't think what I write is that bizarre or weird or out there. And yet I do think a lot of my work is narrative, but it's not sort of direct narrative. And there's obviously, as you've so kindly pointed out, there's elements of surrealism and a real focused attention to sound. And, you know, I often mess around with punctuation, and I think it can make it a little bit more difficult for some readers or editors to really kind of trust that the work will land. And yet I've been very lucky to have it land with readers and writers and editors that I admire. So I think I'm going to let other people tell me if I'm experimental, but I don't think there's much experimenting to it, especially because this is the way I see the world. I was telling somebody the other week, I don't really find these poems to be that surreal or bizarre. I like actually see them in my mind as if they're very hyper real, and that this is something that could or did happen in some alternative world for me. I think if anything, that experimental part comes from, again, the teachers that I've had, the writers that I've been gravitating towards, that once I gave myself, after I did the MFA and was out in the world for a little bit, once I gave myself the permission to write the poems that I would want to read, I think I gave myself a little bit more of that energy, and it's not for everyone, but to hear someone like you, who's so well-read, and you're articulating so many of the things that I haven't even been able to say myself about the book. It's a real joy as a writer to know that the things I was attempting to do were coming through, because it is a funny poem, and it is also sad, and it's weird. But again, to answer your question, I don't know if that makes it experimental, but I think in the grand scheme of maybe other elements of art, it's maybe non-traditional. But yeah, I guess I'll let other people tell me if it's experimental.
You know, but there are even some moments where I was even reminded kind of Emily Dickinson. You know, a lot of her poems are these kind of tight little nuts to crack, and they're very intricate, mm-hmm. and also kind of take on what, you know, feel like we might start overusing this term, but you know, these kind of surreal like qualities, but as a way of really kind of registering the, you know, as you said, it's just like, well, there's a lot of seemingly surreal things going on in the world, and like these things are actually happening. So it's kind of destabilizing our understanding of the surreal, or making it more mundane and more just a part of daily experience. And
100%. And another thing, you know, Dickinson, just the focus on the line. Mm-hmm. Right? Like what is a line doing? What is both the rhythm of that line, but also the actual language in the line doing, and how does the line build with the line before it and after it? And that kind of, you were using this word before, that kind of propulsive nature that can happen in a poem, I really write toward that. And it's because I was fortunate to read writers like Dickinson and have, as Dickinson would have said, the top of my head, you know, blown off by its genius.
Yeah. That's a good problem to have.
Yeah, and just to reiterate for the listeners, I'm saying that about Dickinson's work, not my own, and also as a reference to something Dickinson would have said herself.
Yes, yes. Well, I noticed at one point you made a great reference to her poem, like A Certain Slant of Light, and in one of your poems, mm-hmm. I'm forgetting which one it is, but you were writing about a slant of light, and so again, I was kind of making some connections there. You've mentioned this previously in the conversation, but a recurring trope or a recurring character throughout the collection is this unnamed senator. And we're not sure if it's a single senator, if it's multiple senators, but you know, you frequently mention the senator, legislature is mentioned. And again, you were clearly also taking up with current events. There's mentioning of gun violence. Mm-hmm. Pretty sure I caught a reference to the pandemic in there. You're using a lot of other kind of bureaucratic or administrative or legalese language at times. You talk about like debt, mortgage, credit card interest rates, the deposition. How does poetry help you explore or unpack these topics?
Yeah, what poetry helps me do, it helps me by requiring me to look at it. I think during the height of the early days of the pandemic and all the stuff that was going on with you know, lack of knowledge about what was happening and what do we do with our groceries and do we wipe things down with bleach and what's going on in the world and everybody's got to stay home. And then there's also this election going on. At a certain point, my wife and I just stopped listening to the radio. We would usually listen to public radio in the morning. And it just got to be so overwhelming that instead of continuing to face it, I just walked away from it because I couldn't handle it. And I'm not saying that that's a good idea. I think, you know, citizens should be informed. But I just couldn't look at it. And in the absence of poetry, I think that I would do that with a lot of things. I think that I would do that with my emotions. I think I would do that with relationships, whether that be romantic relationships or familial relationships. I think it can all feel so overwhelming that if I didn't have an outlet that made me consider it, I would just pretend it wasn't there. And I'm not at all suggesting other people should do that. But I think what poetry does for me is it makes me consider and think about my response to it. And so as I was writing these poems, I mentioned obviously the pandemic was going on. You know, I had just gotten married. There was sort of relationship stuff happening. I was thinking about previous relationships and friendships, all while there were so many things happening in our government, from major Supreme Court cases that were handed down during the time of writing these poems that impacted people's bodies and their autonomy to make decisions based on their own bodies, to decisions that came down about guns, to decisions that came down about land rights. It just felt like an onslaught, a constant daily deluge for a little while, for always, it seems like, with just these laws coming down, these elected officials making decisions that were impacting all of us in our pockets, in our bodies, and beyond. And so for me, while that was happening, I didn't, you know, I could talk to my partner about it. I could maybe hop on the phone and talk to a friend, but I wanted to understand what I felt about these things. And the poems gave me that space to write about that absurdity and that anger and that frustration that I had by trying to actually address a person and a senator and all of the administrative bureaucratic stuff you're talking about, to put them in a poem and give me a chance to talk to them or to describe them in a way that gave me an understanding. Obviously, the them is representational here, right? But it gave me a chance to really, like I've been saying, kind of look at it, address it, and understand my own feelings about it. And that is a joy that I will forever have in the creativity of art. It's the space, even if I never shared these poems with anyone, I would still better understand how I feel about these things because I gave myself the time to write it down and write through it.
One of the more arresting poems that I found in the collection, and I think I'd actually like you to read this one now for our listening audience, but it's the one on viewing a sympathetic Nazi perseverance tableau. That's on pages 38 to 39. And in some ways, you know, I found the last poem that you read, I found some similarities in those, you know, as our listeners are about to hear, you know, this one also deals with an animal. A very different reaction, or, you know, maybe not a very different reaction, but this is much starker. And this, this was just a very arresting poem. So would you mind reading that for us, Daniel?
On viewing a sympathetic Nazi perseverance tableau. When I wake up, you are standing on the porch with the body of our now not golden retriever cleaved from belly to neck like an unsteady cancer patient after 7 long seconds at a highly electric rodeo. You refuse to take the dog to the clinic, and I watch you pull from its severed body of irrelevant mass, wet muscle, tethered veins, a stack of old quarters we kept buried in the yard in case the attics returned with the birth of new weather. You throw the blue-red mess near a pile of drowned kindling and bring me the hide saying, please put it on. I try not to breathe or think about the time the dog entered our bedroom dressed as the senator late in the hours of a violent fundraiser. The fur is coarse, and I wear its disguise as you take out a pistol and say it's time for tricks. Shots come hot to the dead ground around me, and I pull to my knees and dance with my waist and paws. You keep shooting, and I keep dancing, and then the county deputy arrives, and you lose your temper. When you get out on bail, I drive us to the river so you can sing Barry White songs with a veteran for change. Around your neck, you keep a picture of my father's last wallet. I promise, this collapse is coming.
It's a chilling closing line to a emotionally powerful poem. Daniel, on your biography that I opened the show with, your first sentence states that you are an Iraqi Jewish American, period. Mm-hmm. Full stop.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your identity and kind of why you foreground it this way in your biography and whether or not you see poetry as a way of addressing some of the issues that arise from this?
Yeah, so my father was born in Iraq and had to escape Iraq with my family due to religious persecution. Without going into a gigantic history lesson here, Babylonian Jewry was a gigantic part of the culture in that part of the world. And the numbers of Jews that were forced to flee Iraq are kind of mind-blowing. And due to that persecution and due to what my father went through simply based on his religion, he became the first person within our family to flee. He ended up in Iran. From Iran, he ended up in Israel. In Israel, he served in the army. He met my mother. They lived in Israel before coming to the States. I've spent my entire life knowing in a sort of hovering sense about what happened to my father without really directly hearing the story of what he experienced, probably until my late 20s, I think was the first time I actually heard the story. Growing up with that kind of pressure, that generational trauma, it made me think a lot about who I was, where I came from, who I want to be, and what those struggles were for. And when I look at my father now, who lives very far away from his family, most of my family after leaving Iraq ended up split between Israel and London. His connection to both religion, but also culture and tradition, he's been separated from it. And yet he survived this terrible experience to give himself a better life, to give his family a better life, and to eventually give me a life. Being an Iraqi Jew is, there just aren't many anymore. And that history, talk about obstinate survival, that willingness to say we are still here is both incredibly important to me, but also to me, it's the, if I could give the love back to my father and obviously my mother too, but just my family for what they went through, I would. There's no other way I can do it other than to say, I see it, I feel it, and I am a part of it. It is in me. And so when I was younger, maybe like a lot of families of immigrants, I tried to hide it. I wanted to be anything other than what I was. I felt different. I looked different. I was othered in many ways. And as I grew up, I came to be more confident in owning that history and really trying to shed light on it, if for nothing else than for someone like you to ask me a question of what does it mean to be an Iraqi Jew, and for me to at least shed light on what the plight of that people was and how those people are still here. And I'm lucky to be a part of that obstinate survival.
Is there a pretty large diaspora of Iraqi Jews, or is there a large group still in Iraq itself, or is it?
Yes, it's a great question. I mean, the number of Jews in Iraq now, the last information that I got on it, and don't quote me on this, I remember the Times did an article on this, I think it was fewer than what you could count on part of one hand. And so if you think about there being single digits of Jews now in a place where before that they were a huge part of that population. And so that diaspora is big. A lot of Iraqi Jews ended up in, like I said, Israel, in London. There's a group of Iraqi Jews in the Detroit area, in Canada. Every once in a while I was in Texas a couple weeks ago to give a reading, and I met someone who was of Iraqi Jewish descent as well. And it just, from the food to the culture to just the memories, you know, my father's first language, and his second language for that matter, but his first language is Arabic, and it's a language I don't speak. To be separated from your family's mother tongue is interesting. I was in Israel this summer, and I have aunts and uncles, but one of my aunts, whom I love dearly, will often speak to me in Hebrew or Arabic, and I can't speak as fluently as I want to in either of those languages. And she seems to not always trust her English, even though she's very good at it. And it feels like we're kind of always communicating through hugs, and that's all we can do. And that's another reason why I think art is so beautiful, because it allows time and space for interpretation, and it allows for us to kind of share those emotions in various ways. And even if someone may not get everything I'm trying to say, if there's a rhythm or an emotional kind of resonance, maybe that does the work. And, you know, earlier you were talking about music and sound. A lot of that in my writing directly comes from being a descendant of an Iraqi Jew, hearing Arabic, hearing Hebrew in my house, hearing old Arabic records being played. hearing, and I love him to death, my father speak at times in a kind of broken English, it changed the way I understood syntax. It made me place words in different orders because that's what I heard growing up. And so, I have that in my bio to honor all of the people that suffered and to really own and connect with that experience. And I certainly wouldn't be the writer that I am today or the person that I am today if those people hadn't been obstinate and survived in the way that they did and continue to do.
First, I should say thank you for sharing that. And in the final moments of our program, because we do try and spotlight local authors or authors who do have a Madison connection, you know, another element of your bio is that you were once a student at the University of Wisconsin.
Yes.
Could you just reflect on that a little bit and what your experiences of Madison have been?
For sure. So maybe I've said this numerous times, but I would not be a writer. I would not be sitting here on this in this call and doing this interview with you if it hadn't been for the experience I had in Madison. I came to Madison as an out-of-state student. The idea was I would be a business major. I started taking business classes and hated every one of them. I was terrible at math. I am terrible at math. And I always loved language. I'd taken an English class where a professor had sort of noted that I had written a strong paper and wanted to know if she could share it with the rest of the class. And it was one of the first times anyone had ever pointed out that I had done something with strength. And through that kind of encouragement, I took another writing class. I decided to change my major to English. I told my parents, my grandfather, I remember. And I think they all thought, well, okay, if you major in English, you can go to law school. But that never happened. The thing that Madison gave me for the first time in my life was a community of other artists. And so there was sort of like a freak thing that happened, which was I was in a creative writing poetry class with a very small number of people, I think maybe 8 or 9 of us. And almost every one of those writers went on to go get an MFA and put out books and works in the world of arts in some way. Two of those writers, Carol Pagel and Adam Fell, became not only my first best readers, but they became lifelong friends. And even to this day, they're the writers and readers that I want to read and that I want to read my work. I wouldn't have known about MFA programs if I hadn't bumped into Carol Pagel on the street with a stack of manila envelopes and asked her what they were for, and she told me what an MFA program was. I wouldn't have succeeded at Iowa in just sort of getting through the sort of grind that is an MFA program. I didn't have friends like that. And also the teachers that I had, Ron Wallace, Jesse Lee Kirchival, the other folks that were running the program, Ron Kuka, the fellows that were there, Shrikanth Reddy, Erica Meitner, writers that have continued to inspire me, teachers that taught me what it meant to be in a classroom. I saw all of it firsthand because of what Madison provided for me. And every day I go to work here at the University of Iowa, I try to emulate that experience. I try to give students a chance to feel community. I try to be an educator that is supportive of the creative and professional arts in any way I can. And that's all because of what I got in Madison. And I was fortunate to be back in Madison a couple weeks ago. And, you know, I just walk around State Street and all I feel is joy. It is a town that has my heart and will forever have it.
Well, there you have it, Madison. A love note from Daniel from Daniel Kalachi. It's great to hear what a strong literary community, both the university and then just both the city of Madison, what they were able to provide you and so many others. And our listening audience, you know, they make up such a strong portion of that as well. So today, we have been in conversation with Daniel Kalachi about his new poetry collection, The Story of Your Obstinate Survival, published by the University of Wisconsin Press this past March, so you can get it wherever you get your poetry books. Daniel, it has been a pleasure having you on Madison BookBeat today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Andrew, and thanks for all you do in support of writers, authors, and the literary community. It means the world to all of us.
Absolutely. You have been listening to Madison BookBeat, and I've been your host, Andrew Thomas. I'll be back on Monday, June 3rd, for a conversation with Henry Wise on his new novel, Holy City. Don't miss it. You can find a full-length recording of this interview on WORTFM.org and a podcast version wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe to Madison BookBeat to stay up to date on Madison authors, topics, book events, and publishers. Thanks to today's talk producer, Jade Iseri-Ramos, and news director, Shali Pittman. My man, Alex Frizzell, wrote and performed the intro and outro music. Coming up next is 3 hours of jazz with Alex Wilding White, so keep it here on WORT 89.9 FM Madison, listener-sponsored community radio.